couple with whom they were staying for the tournament. "Agnes and Brahma are very good friends of ours," Stan said. "I hope to introduce you to them before the tournament is over." I was curious to find out what kinds of individuals the two were because their last name sounded Afrikaner, and I still had yet to meet an Afrikaner who did not believe in apartheid. I asked Stan and Marjorie to tell me more about the couple before I met them. What they told me about Agnes was shocking. She and her family used to live in Nairobi, Kenya. During the Mau Mau uprising of the 1950s, she and her family refused to build a fence around their home despite warnings that it was dangerous not to do so. The reason Agnes's father refused to build the fence was that he felt that he was on such good terms with the Mau Maus, he had nothing to fear. One day, while Agnes was in America, the Mau Maus went on a hunt for a white man to sacrifice to tribal gods. They stormed Agnes's home, killed her mother, and hauled her father to a mountaintop where they buried him alive. Incredibly, a few years later, Agnes returned to the village of those who had murdered her parents to minister to them of the love of Christ. She told the Mau Maus that she did not harbor any hatred toward them for leaving her an orphan. I was moved by the story. It reinforced my belief that among white South Africans, there was that small minority that really believed in love, freedom, and human dignity for all. So why should they be lumped into the same foul den as the racists and made the object of hate and vengeance? Why couldn't the struggle in South Africa be not one of black against white, but one that pitted those who believed in freedom, justice, and equality against those who didn't? Finally, the day neared for Stan and Marjorie to return to the United States. We had become such good friends that I cried at the thought of them leaving. Our being together, their understanding of my life and dreams, and their encouragement that I remain resolute in my faith, that in the end things would work out for the good, had filled me with hope for the future. And suddenly it seemed that in leaving they were taking that hope with them. Nothing definite had come up regarding the scholarship, except Stan's promise to pursue the matter diligently upon arrival in the States. "How long will it be before I hear from the schools?" I asked, with a tinge of impatience. Stan and I had arranged to meet at Ellis Park. "I'll be matriculating soon, and I need to at least have an idea about what lies ahead." "Well," Stan said, "I can't guarantee that you'll hear from the school, not right away anyway. These things take time, but you'll definitely be hearing from Marjorie and me. And please do write and tell us how you're doing." "Thanks for everything," I said. "What are your plans now that the tournament will soon be over?" Stan asked. "I'm banned for life from black tennis, as you know," I said. "So I guess I'll have to test the new government policy sanctioning interracial sports. I'll apply for membership at one of Johannesburg's whites-only tennis clubs. If I'm refused membership, then I'll just keep practicing at the ranch and pray that you come up with something." "Are there any more tournaments you can play in?" Stan asked. "Not that I can..." Before I could finish the sentence, something flashed across my mind. "Oh, you know, Stan," I said excitedly, "there's a series of tournaments called the Sugar Circuit, which begin immediately following the SAB Open. They're held in 4 or 5 cities along the coast: Durban, Port Elizabeth, East London, Bloemfontein, and Cape Town. Before the boycott, a few black players took part in 1 or 2 of them. The Sugar Circuit, which Arthur Ashe demanded be integrated in 1973, was regarded as the training ground for many of the world's future tennis professionals." "How does one enter such tournaments?" Stan asked. "Owen Williams might know," I said. "We found Owen Williams in his office, and he told Stan and me that though the date for accepting entries for some of the tournaments on the Sugar Circuit was already passed, he could arrange for me to play in any of them. "How many would you like to play in?" Stan asked. "Oh, one or two," I said arbitrarily. "I would have liked to play in all of them." Stan told Owen that he would pay for all my expenses to the tournaments in Port Elizabeth and Cape Town. I was speechless. I wanted to cry, to dance, to fall on my knees and worship Stan. Owen estimated that to play both tournaments would cost about 600 rands, $500. I calculated how long it would take my father, with his salary of 10 rands a week, to come up with such an amount. He would have had to work continuously for a year, getting up at 4 in the morning and coming home at 9 in the evening, and would have to go without food, medical treatment, paying rent, etc. Such a calculation drove home the enormous obstacles facing black boys and girls with dreams of someday becoming Arthur Ashes and Althea Gibsons. I was awakened from my reverie by Stan saying the following to Owen. "And I think Mark will need rackets, tennis shoes, shirts, and shorts." Stan then arranged for me to get 3 Maxply rackets from a Wilson distributor in downtown Johannesburg. Andre strung them for me for free. Owen got in touch with Abe Siegel, who owned a clothing label, and I received a dozen shorts and shirts from him. Stan and Marjorie had promised to apply for permits to visit my family, but because of time constraints, Stan was in the finals of the doubles championship and in the semi-finals of the singles competition, and the bureaucracy involved in getting a permit, they could not make it. Stan lost a closely fought semi-final match to the Argentinian Guillermo Villas, but he and Lutz handily won the doubles crown. Stan and Marjorie left. Owen handed over the arrangements for my trip to Port Elizabeth and Cape Town to Jeffrey Montsitsi, director of the BTF and my only supporter when black tennis officials voted to ban me from black tennis. All along, I had kept my pending trip to the Sugar Circuit a secret even from my family. So when one day I came home with a box full of tennis clothes and new tennis rackets, my mother demanded to know where I had stolen everything. I told her about Stan sponsoring me. For a few minutes, she said nothing. Then suddenly tears began streaming down her cheeks. "They're full of God's love, child," she said. "Pray with me that He should bless and protect them all through their lives. They're special human beings." I kneeled down with my mother, and we prayed. Chapter 51. News that Stan had sponsored me to play the Sugar Circuit stunned a lot of people. It infuriated some of the black tennis officials who had banned me, and they began circulating word that Stan had wasted his money on a traitor who did not deserve such help. They claimed that there were better black tennis players than I. I knew that this was jealousy, intended to discredit and destroy me as a tennis player, and it bothered me and made me angry. "Don't pay attention to all this nonsense," scoffed Mr. Montsitsi. I was in his office at Q Promotions to plan the itinerary for my trip. "They can bark all they want," I said. "Haven't they just banned me from the association? So who the hell are they to decide whether I deserve the sponsorship or not? I'm the one who took the initiative to befriend Stan and Marjorie." "Everything is set for your trip," Mr. Muntsisi said, perusing several documents. "You'll be leaving from Jan Smuts Airport. In Port Elizabeth, you'll be staying at a hotel right near the tennis courts. It's one of the multinational hotels which don't practice apartheid. Not overtly, anyway. And in Cape Town, I've made arrangements for you to stay at the home of a Transkeian diplomat who lives right in the middle of Cape Town, about half a mile from the tennis courts. I think you'll love Cape Town. You said my host is a Transkeian diplomat? What sort of diplomat? He's head of the Transkeian consulate. You know the whole homeland business. This man and his family are allowed to live in the posh all-white section of Cape Town. Transkei, the so-called Xhosa homeland, which Pretoria had prodded to accept an independence so specious no other country in the world would recognize it, had an embassy and consulates throughout what the government called white South Africa. The most curious thing was that though many of the Transkeian diplomats, including the Prime Minister himself and his entire cabinet, were regarded as kafirs by whites before being granted independence, they now had been given the status of honorary whites, which meant that technically they were no longer subject to South Africa's dehumanizing racial laws. Many blacks believed that such arbitrary racial classification was blatant proof that the government had created apartheid not because God so ordained, or that the various races were so radically different they could not coexist as one nation, as white supporters of racial segregation claimed. Apartheid was purely and simply a scheme to perpetuate white dominance, greed, and privilege. Surely there is no justification under the sun for regarding a Chinese as a non-white and a Japanese as white, a black living in Soweto or Alexandra as a native, and a black from America as an honorary white, and from Zambia or Zimbabwe as a foreign native. Despite my detestation of those blacks who went along with the government's policy of homelands, stripping blacks of citizenship in the rich and luscious parts of South Africa and forcing them to become citizens of fragmented deserts, I agreed to stay at the home of the Transkeian diplomat in Cape Town. I wanted to find out his reasons for selling out on his race. I left for Port Elizabeth on a Sunday, 2 weeks before Christmas 1977. Throughout the two-hour trip from Jan Smuts Airport to Port Elizabeth, I couldn't stop staring out through the window. I was awed by the immense beauty of South Africa, seen from high up in the clouds, rolling hills and plains, meandering rivers and mountain ranges, thick forests, magnificent coastlines, luscious farmland. There's room for everyone, I said to myself, in this beloved country. If only apartheid went ruining it for everybody. I was the only black person on the plane, and I felt out of place. A middle-aged white woman with a long nose and a fastidiously made-up face was the only other passenger in the row. Each time our eyes met, she smiled. I returned a never smile. I wish there were other black faces on the plane, people I could talk to, laugh with, and tell how nervous and delighted I was on my first plane ride. Suddenly, I felt something inside that horrified me. I wanted to go to the bathroom. Were there any bathrooms for blacks on the plane? We had another hour before reaching Port Elizabeth, and I felt I couldn't hold out that long. I didn't only want to urinate. I wanted to do the other stuff as well. Bizarre thoughts thronged my mind. What would white people do to me if I started smelling like shit? Would they demand that I be thrown off the plane? There were no parachutes, so how could I hope to reach Earth alive? My stomach churned. I finally mustered enough courage to call one of the 6 stewardesses, all white, who had said to me with a smile when I entered the plane, "Welcome aboard, sir. We hope you have a pleasant flight." "Excuse me, miss," I said, embarrassed. "I would like to use the bathroom." "There's one in the back of the plane, sir," she said. I turned my head and saw two of them, opposite each other. I was about to get up when I saw two white women, one coming out of each. I quickly slumped back into the seat. The stewardess was gone. She came back minutes later. "Excuse me, miss," I said. "Are those two the only toilets on the plane?"
"Yes."
"The only ones?" I said incredulously.
"Yes."
"Are they occupied?" she asked innocently.
"I don't know," I said.
She went back to the rear, looked at the doors of the two toilets, and came back.
"They're vacant, sir," she said.
"Thank you very much," I said. The plane came across rough winds and it shook. I staggered down the aisle, all the time thinking of parachutes.
"The captain requests that, for your safety, you should fasten your seatbelts," a stewardess said.
I spun and was about to dive for my seat when one stewardess said,
"You can go to the bathroom, sir. That was merely a precaution."
I reached the toilets and glanced at the doors. Each read, "Unoccupied."
Which one should I go into?
I remembered the incident years ago when Granny was bedeviled by the two identical telephone booths. I settled for the one on my left. When I returned to my seat, the white woman sitting beside me spoke to me for the first time.
"Are you a tennis player?"
she asked in a heavy British accent.
"Yes, ma'am," I said.
"From overseas?"
"No, ma'am," I said. "From this country." In a surprised voice, she said,
"Oh, where?"
"Johannesburg."
"You must be good to travel on a plane," she said.
"And all those rackets, are you a professional?"
"No, ma'am. I'm still at school."
"Where? In Soweto?"
"No, Tembisa, near Kempton Park." We began talking about tennis. She told me she had been to Wimbledon several times, that she was an above-average club player, and that all her family was involved with tennis back in England. We discussed some of Britain's top players who had recently played in South Africa. Buster Mottram, Roger Taylor, Virginia Wade, Ann Hobbs, Andrew Jarrett. We then switched to the black tennis situation in South Africa and, in particular, the conspicuous lack of champions of Arthur Ashe's caliber. In an act of pride, I told her that I was determined to change all that by becoming the first black South African to win Wimbledon.
"I think you can do it," she said with a smile.
When we arrived in Port Elizabeth, it was bright and sunny. I took a taxi to the 5-star hotel where I had been booked. A dozen or so white tennis players were staying at the hotel, which was an ornately furnished place. The suite where I stayed was on par with many of the bedrooms of white people I had seen my mother clean. Several things about the place filled me with anger and brought tears to my eyes. I was treated like a dignitary. Meals were regular and scrumptious, and I had a large color television set in my room, whose floor was decked with Persian carpets. I even discovered a bell for room service. All this for 150 rands a week. As I snored in a double bed, back in Alexandra, meantime, my parents most likely were being marched out of their rickety single bed by the police. Most likely, there wasn't enough food to feed all my siblings. Most likely, vicious red ants were gnawing at my sisters as they slept on the damp, porous floor. The 150 rands that had been used to pay for my hotel accommodations for a week could have
easily kept the family alive for 4 months. I had wished to live modestly during the trip and send whatever money I saved home, but everything had already been prepaid. The other thing that made me angry was how gray-haired black men and women, old enough to be my grandparents, insisted on calling me Master and Sir, despite my begging them to address me as my son or my child. "If we call you that, sir, word may get back to the bus of the hotel and we will be fired." "But I'm one of you." "We want to keep our jobs." "But I'm from South Africa." "We want to keep our jobs." Many South African whites I met during meals in the dining hall thought I was a black American. They were courteous, respectful, and treated me as an equal. I played along. There were several American tennis players staying at the same hotel. I introduced myself to them, told them about my friendship with Stan. They were impressed and we began practicing together. I drew a bye in the first round of the tournament. So, on opening day, I had to practice on some courts overlooking the Indian Ocean, only to be frustrated by gusting winds, and I stopped to go sightseeing around Port Elizabeth. Toward afternoon, the wind diminished somewhat, but the courts were all taken, and I decided to go down to the beach and lie in the sun and think about my match the following day. I didn't get the chance. The wide beach with fine golden sand, the calmest waves and the clearest blue water, a few blocks away from the hotel, was reserved for whites. The beach for blacks, someone told me, was a strip of rock littered with seaweed and dead crabs some 3 miles from where I was staying. I was not allowed either to visit the Indian and colored beaches, which were somewhat closer and better than the black beach. I spent the evening watching state-controlled television and writing letters home. In the morning, the wind was gusting again. My opponent, a white South African who grew up near Port Elizabeth, was used to playing under windy conditions, and he won the match in straight sets. I teamed up with a white South African junior player from Cape Town in doubles. We won our first round match and lost in 3 sets in the second. Out of the tournament in both singles and doubles, and unable to visit the black ghettos of Port Elizabeth because of rioting there, I left for Cape Town 2 days before the week ended. I hoped to use the 2 days before the tournament began to see as much as possible of what many regarded as the most beautiful city in South Africa, to acclimatize myself to the Cape weather and, most important, to visit the black ghettos of Guguletu and Nyanga, scene of the West Rebellion in the Cape Province during the 1976-77 student protests. The Transkeian diplomat and his wife met me at the airport. He was a short, dumpy man, and his wife fitted roughly the same description. The two lived with their 3 young daughters in a penthouse. From their home, on a clear day, one had a breathtaking view of Table Mountain with a thick cloud of fog hovering over Devil's Peak. Cape Town was known as the home of the coloureds and was one of the few places in South Africa where blacks were a minority. Given its long miscegenation history, began when Jan van Riebeeck and his men, the first whites to settle South Africa, arrived in 1652 without wives, the city was purported to be a most liberal place. But the liberalism, I soon found out, was skin deep, applying only between coloureds and whites. Blacks were still throttled by the full apartheid machinery. I hope to play better in Cape Town, to make up for my poor performance in Port Elizabeth.
So the day I arrived, I immediately began training by going for a light jog late in the evening. Along one of the streets, I stepped into a pothole and severely sprained my ankle. The next day, it was so swollen, I couldn't even put my foot in a shoe. My first match was 2 days away. I was determined to play despite the injury. I didn't want to give critics back home ammunition to attack me further. I could hear them saying things like, "He went to Port Elizabeth. How did he fare? He lost in straight sets. Maybe we shouldn't totally fault him for the loss. He may have been extremely nervous and couldn't play his game. He went to Cape Town. How did he do there? He lost again. Doesn't that prove he's not good enough? That he's a token player shoved into the limelight for effect?" I hobbled my way to a 6-0-6-1 loss. The injury forced me to scratch out of the doubles competition. I was miserable. Why me? Why me? I had so much to prove by playing my best. I could see Stan receiving an anonymous missive detailing my humiliating defeat, ending with a statement, "Don't waste your time on him." I could see Stan abandoning all efforts to help me obtain a tennis scholarship. I could see myself remaining in South Africa, an outcast, rejected by the Black Tennis Association and not accepted by the White Tennis Association because of apartheid. I could see myself leaving tennis. What would my life be without the game? I snapped out of my depression and began making arrangements to visit Guguletu and Nyanga and conduct some tennis clinics there. I solicited old rackets and tennis balls from the players and the tournament organizers. I managed to get a few things. Guguletu and Nyanga were other Alexandras, hovels of poverty. The two tennis courts were run down and buried under weeds. I got youngsters to help me clear some of the weeds. The tennis clinic was a success. Dozens of eager black boys and girls showed up. Many had talent. I knew that if they couldn't continue receiving the coaching, they would simply give up and drift into gangs and other vices. So I wrote the Black Tennis Foundation and told Mr. Muntisi about them. The diplomat regarded himself as a staunch opponent of apartheid. When I asked him why then was he part of the homeland lie, he told me that the best way to destroy the system was from within. I told him that I respected his views but didn't agree with them. One day he took me to the Crossroads squatters camp. What I saw there made me cry. The place was worse than any ghetto I'd ever seen. The shacks were made of plastic, tin, and cardboard and stood near clumps of blue gum trees, whose branches screamed like ghosts in the icy Cape wind. There was no running water, sewerage system, street lights, or privacy. Malnourished children ran around half naked, with distended bellies and large heads full of sores. Here and there, a mangy dog licked the bloody feces of a child with dysentery. Here and there, a rasping cough of someone with tuberculosis issued from a shack. Women washed their rags in leaky, rusted washtubs. "Every single day," the diplomat said, "these people have to wake up at dawn, dismantle their shacks and hide them in the bush because the authorities raid the place each morning with tear gas launchers, bulldozers and crowbars. The authorities have decreed that Crossroads should go." I had heard about that decree. Since independence was foisted on the Transkei,
the tens of thousands of Khoisas living in Crossroads were to be stripped of their South African citizenship and deported to the tribal reserve. But in the Transkei, as in all the other poverty-stricken homelands, blacks could not eke out a living. That was the main reason why many flocked to the cities to seek work. The Pretoria government paid no attention to such facts in its mad pursuit of its homeland nightmare. So black families were forcibly torn apart, with men remaining in single-sex barracks to work in the cities, and women and children deported to starve and suffer in homelands ruled by Pretoria-anointed dictators, whose brutality against their own kind often surpassed that of the South African government. The motive of apartheid was clear. Divide and rule. Pit brother against brother, sister against sister. When I returned from Cape Town, I started working part-time for the BTF. It was a non-paying job. I took it not only because I wanted to help boys and girls learn the game, and I hoped stay out of trouble, but also because I didn't know what to do with my life. The matric results hadn't come out, and I hadn't received word from Stan. I had learned a lot from my stint on the sugar circuit. One being that there was no way I was ever going to improve my game to any respectable level if I didn't constantly play against whites who were more skilled and experienced. Now that I was banned from black tennis, it was easier on my mind whether to decide to seek membership at a white club. I talked the matter over with Wilfred, Andre, and Scaramouche, and all three supported my intention. I decided to seek membership at the Wondrous Club, one of the finest, most prestigious, and most exclusive of clubs in South Africa. It was a bright and sunny Monday morning when I took the black bus to Rosebank, where the Wondrous Tennis Club was located, about a mile or so from where the Smiths used to live. "The Wondrous Club, please," I said, handing the driver 15 cents. He gave me a used ticket, which was against the Patco company policy. I stared at the ticket. "We have to make money somehow, brother," he said. "The white man isn't paying us enough." "I understand, brother," I said, making my way into the bus. We stopped at Bramley, and the bus immediately filled with black women in maid uniforms, returning to work after their day off visiting their children or husbands or relatives in the ghetto. "Take my seat," I said to an old woman who was standing alongside waiting for the little boy next to me to offer her a seat. The little boy pretended to be asleep. "Thank you, my son," the old woman said. "May God make you live to a ripe old age, and his blessings follow you wherever you go." "Thank you, Grandma," I replied. I arrived at the Wondrous Club in an unusually happy mood, feeling that it was my lucky day. There was a tribal superstition I clung to, which said that if one did others a good turn, things would go right for that one day. The Wondrous Club parking lot was filled with expensive cars. Mercedes-Benzes, Volvos, Jaguars, and Rolls-Royces. What am I doing in such circles? Can I really hope to be accepted? As I walked toward the administrative building, I saw a couple of white schoolboys heading for a vast cricket field that was part of the Wondrous Club. Minutes later, I met a couple of young black school-age boys dressed in rags, lugging huge golf bags to the 18-hole course nearby. I entered the palatial building through the front door and walked confidently down the corridor decorated from wall to wall by trophies and plaques honoring winners of wondrous tournaments since the club was founded. I didn't bother reading any of the names on the trophies or plaques, for I knew none of them belonged to a black person. Maybe someday my children would walk down the same aisle and read my name among those, I dreamed. I was abruptly awakened from my reverie by a snarling black guard.
What do you want here, boy? Are you lost? He said in Zulu.
No, I'm looking for Mr. Ferguson. You have any message for the boss?
I want to talk to him.
He eyed me suspiciously, then said,
The boss is not around, boy.
Can I leave him a message at his office?
Give me the message, the guard demanded. I'll deliver it.
I'd rather do it personally, if you don't mind, I said.
The boss is not here. Now get out.
The club in his hand made me leave. I tried another entrance. Along a different corridor, I met a young white woman in tennis attire.
Can you please tell me where Mr. Ferguson's office is?
Certainly. Just around the corner to your left.
I came to a door with a sign. Mr. Ferguson, President of the Wondrous Lawn Tennis Association. I knocked.
Come in, said a rich male voice. I paused a short while, then went in.
What can I do for you?
I'm the one who plays at the Barrett's Tennis Ranch, I said. I believe Owen Williams told you about me?
Oh, yes. You're the young man who took part in the SAB Open. Oh, sit down, please. How was your trip to the circuit?
Stan is a nice person, isn't he?
How's your tennis coming along?
I answered all questions.
So, I hear you're thinking of applying for membership at our club.
Yes, sir. I need the competition. You understand now that you're the first black person ever to apply for membership?
Yes, sir. I hope I'm qualified.
There's no doubt as to your qualifications. You are a fine tennis player, well-mannered and able to speak English. Rather well, I must say. I smiled.
I personally would like to see you become a member, he said. It's about time we allowed hard-working players like you in. But the decision is not mine alone. I wish it were. I have to present your case to the full committee at our next meeting. I have no doubt the committee would be sympathetic, but as I see it, even if they vote to accept you, there are several serious obstacles which can't be overcome overnight. I wish they could.
What are they, sir? I said.
He proceeded to tell me a nauseatingly familiar story, one I had expected to hear. The government's multiracial sports policy mandated that if blacks were accepted to any white clubs, separate showers, locker rooms, restaurants, and bathrooms had to be created for them.
It seemed unlikely, Mr. Ferguson said, that the trustees of the club would approve the spending of thousands of rands for the creation of facilities to serve one black tennis player.
It may take time for the law to be changed, Mr. Ferguson said. But white sports officials across the country are working around the clock to get the government to act fast.
I understand, sir.
One thing which may be possible is for you to play in our tournaments.
I don't think there'll be any problems with that.
All you'll have to do would be to use the servants' bathrooms and eat where they eat.
I'll think of it, sir. I left.
So this was the white men's version of integrated sports. I was an outcast from the black tennis world, and the white tennis world wasn't ready to accept me. So where did I belong? What should I do? Was this the end? The only way I saw out was if I obtained a tennis scholarship to America. Could I?
I hadn't heard anything from Stan. It was now the middle of January, nearly a month and a half since Stan and Marjorie left for the United States. Had they forgotten about me? Had they received the letter I wrote them thanking them for all their help? The results of the matriculation exams were due in a few days. I had no doubt I had passed, despite the difficulties of the past school year. But what would I do with the matriculation certificate? I had two options: go on to university or seek work. I could not see myself going to any of the inferior tribal universities run by white apartheid ideologues. It would simply mean more intellectual stunting, anger, frustration, and hatred. After all the changes my personality had undergone, all those battles I had fought for the right to undergo those changes, and the price I had paid to feel and think and act like a human being, I could not see myself reverting back to the yes boss mentality. Chapter 52. It can't be. It's not true. It can't be, I muttered to myself over and over, clutching a copy of the world. The matriculation exams had come out, and my name wasn't in the paper, which could mean only one thing. I had failed. That was inconceivable. All my 13 years in school, I only had to worry about whether I was going to come out number one or two in class, not if I was going to pass or fail. Yet here it was, in black and white, the possibility that I might have failed. It was late afternoon, and there was no way I could take the bus to Tembisa to confront the principal about what surely must be a mistake. Wasn't I one of the best students in school? Then how could I have failed? There must be a mistake, child, my mother said in a shaking voice. How could you have failed? My name is not in the paper, Mama, I said. I still believe there's a mistake, she said. I'll find out tomorrow, I said. I took the first school bus to Tembisa. I found many of my classmates thronging the principal's office, copies of yesterday's newspapers in their hands. They too had come to protest the results. We too are baffled about the results, the principal, flanked by several matriculation teachers, addressed us. We expected many of you to do well based on your performance over the 2 years. But when the results came from Pretoria, we found that many of you had failed. They deliberately failed us, the bloody Boers, shouted a student. They don't want us to go on to university because they know we'll carry on the struggle there. I managed to see the principal alone, and he showed me the computer printouts from Pretoria. Yes, I had obtained a third-class pass because I had failed my mother tongue. I had obtained A's and B's in all the other subjects. But because I had failed Tsonga, which carried more weight, I had failed. But sir, I said, even without my mother tongue, my average comes out higher than a second class pass. So how could I have failed? Beats me too, he said. That's why we have lodged a protest with the Department of Bantu Education. We think that the computer must have made a mistake. We hope to hear from them in a week or two. I went back home in a daze. What would I do with a third-class pass? I wouldn't be allowed to enter even a black South African university with that. So how could I hope to enter an American one if I was to be awarded a tennis scholarship? Why did I have to fail now?
Did the government know of my intention to study in America? And was this an effort to stop me?
My future appeared blotted out. I sunk into depression. I couldn't eat or play tennis. I couldn't think of anything but the matriculation results and what they meant. I pinned my hopes on the thought that a mistake had definitely been made by the Department of Bantu Education, as would be shown when the principal's inquiry was answered. The reply came back, along with the certificate. I had failed my mother tongue, no doubt about that. But on going over my exam transcripts and finding I had passed every other subject with high marks, the Department of Bantu Education's advisory board had decided to award me a second class instead of a third class pass. But still I couldn't enter any tribal university because I had failed my mother tongue. That week a letter arrived from Stan.
Dear Mark, Margie and I arrived home safely and are doing fine. We received your letter some time ago, and are glad you had a relatively good time on the sugar circuit. Sorry about the injury, but that often happens in the game. Hope you've fully recovered and are back on the court. I did manage to get in touch with George Toley, my coach at USC, and he's indicated a willingness to help. The NCAA tournament will be taking place in Georgia shortly, and he intends to approach the coaches of the various schools on your behalf. He might be writing you directly as soon as he has anything. I'll be away on the tour. In case you need to get hold of me, write to my Washington address. Keep in touch. Margie sends her love. We're expecting our first child sometime in July. Take care. Your friend, Stanley Roger Smith. The letter was a welcome relief. It took my mind off my brooding over the second class pass. I immediately sat down to reply. I told Stan and Marjorie that I had passed matriculation, but omitted mentioning that it was with a second class certificate. My mother asked me one morning what I planned to do now that I had completed school.
Are you going to take that job from the Simba Chips company? She asked.
No, I said.
What are you going to do? She said. You can't go to university with a second class pass, can you?
Yes.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to wait till I hear news from America.
You still dreaming about going to America?
My mother sighed.
How can you go to America with a second class pass?
They'll take me, I said.
If I were you, I'd stop dreaming and start working.
I don't have a pass, I offered as an excuse. Then go get one. We don't have a permit allowing us to be in Alexandria, I said. And our other papers are not in order. So how can the authorities give me a pass?
They'll give you one, she said.
I wasn't hopeful of getting a pass. Besides, I didn't want one. It represented too much emotional pain. I knew that once I had one, supposing I could get one, the system would have succeeded in shackling my being with a chain I would never be able to unloose. It was now February, and I still had no job. I spent my days playing tennis at the ranch, hoping for a letter from Stan or George Toley telling me that some university in America had decided to award me a tennis scholarship. Then I would have no need for a pass or a job. I would finally be free to pursue my life's dream, to become a professional tennis player. But everyone thought I was hallucinating in thinking I could become a professional tennis player, let alone get to America.
Scaramouche and Wilfred thought I had a remote chance of getting to America. But they both urged me to get a job, preferably one that would allow me time to practice and play in tournaments. Despite being refused membership to White Clubs, I was now allowed to take part in their tournaments. I had played in three of them and done rather well. The authorities knew that I was playing in white tournaments, but they did nothing to stop me. They probably thought that those blacks who saw me as a traitor for mixing with whites would soon get rid of me. By playing in white tennis tournaments, I got to meet Keith Brebner, coach of one of South Africa's crack junior tennis squads. Some of the players who had trained under him had gone on to win scholarships to prestigious American universities and later became world-class tennis stars. Players like Johan Kriek, Kevin Curran, Roslyn Fairbanks, Robbie Venter, Derek Siegel, Ilana Kloss, Derek Tarr, Christo Steyn, Rory Chappell. Andre arranged with Keith for me to join the squad. Stan Smith is trying to get him a scholarship to America, Andre told Keith, so practicing with your team will prepare him for the rigors of American collegiate tennis, should he get the scholarship. I became the first black allowed on the squad. Every Saturday morning for 8 weeks, I would take a bus to Ellis Park, where the team trained. I couldn't believe how sophisticated and exciting tennis training could be, provided one had the proper facilities and qualified coaches. The squad of a dozen or so boys and girls, among the cream of the crop in South African junior tennis, was drilled by Keith and his assistants on the ways to hit forehands, backhands, volleys, drop shots, serves, lobs, etc., with power and precision. We had lessons on court coverage, percentage tennis, mental attitude for winning tennis, and strategy and tactics. None of these things were taught, as far as I could tell, in black tennis circles. If they were, definitely not with as much clarity and depth as among whites. As the only black player on the squad, I was overly self-conscious at first and performed below par. Gradually, however, as the white players began opening up to me, talking, laughing, and even joking, I began feeling comfortable in their midst, with the result that I was soon playing at their level. The improvement I would have made in years of playing tennis in the ghetto would not have equaled the improvement I made in those 8 weeks with the squad. Some of the white players on the squad started inviting me to their homes during the week, where they had floodlit courts. Through such interaction, I learned a lot about white people, their unfounded fears, the difficulties they faced in trying to figure out who the black man really was, what it was he wanted, why he hated whites, why there was such tension among the races. I would be asked, "How can we live with you people when you hate us so much?" I would reply that for as long as meaningful contact between the races was forbidden by law, the stereotypes each race had of the other would persist. Blacks would continue being suspicious of the motives of whites, and whites would continue being suspicious of the motives of blacks. Blacks would continue hating whites, and whites would continue fearing blacks. Everything blacks said was good for the country, whites would say was bad, and vice versa. Apartheid, I said, thrived on the enmity and fear between black and white. At the end of the 8 week, Keith took me aside following practice and gave me an evaluation of my game. "You've made tremendous progress, but I think it's important that you keep on playing against stiff competition. That way you won't lose the gains you've already made. Tennis is like a muscle. it atrophies when not exercised and nourished. And the exercise and nourishment your game needs is to play more tournaments and practice against good players. The level of competition among American universities is very high, so you'll need to be ready.
Will any of the players on the squad be around even after we disband? I asked.
No, said Keith. Many of them are leaving to play junior tournaments in America and Europe.
Can I go? I said in jest.
He smiled.
Do you have 3,000 rands?
I did not have that kind of money.
Do the players pay for the trip themselves?
Yes, their parents do.
It would have taken my father almost 5 years to come up with the money to finance the summer-long trip. So this was what I was up against as a black tennis player. I just somehow had to get to America.
Chapter 53. One day, I was arrested for being in a white neighborhood after the 10 o'clock evening curfew, and for being without a bus. I told the arresting officers, one black and one white, that I was a student. Luckily, I was in the habit of carrying several books with the name of my former school on them. They let me go with the warning to get a bus.
You are 18 years old now, said the black officer. You should have got one 2 years ago.
I began making plans to go apply for one, even though I detested the idea of carrying a bus. At the pass office, I was interrogated by a young black man in a checkered suit who appeared to enjoy the job he was doing, putting his own folks through hell.
I've come to apply for a pass, I said. I was dressed in my Sunday best.
What's your name? He said, placing his shiny shoes across the table and leaning back on the swivel chair, twirling a silver pen. He had copied every mannerism of his boss.
I told him my name.
How old are you?
18.
Who are your parents?
I told him.
Where do they live?
I told him.
What tribe are they from?
I told him. He jotted everything down on a pad.
What schools did you attend?
I told him.
Who were your principals?
I told him. I was getting irritated with each question.
Have you been arrested before?
No.
How long have your parents been living in Alexandria?
25 years.
Continuously in the same place?
We moved a couple times.
Where does your father work?
Germiston.
How long has he been working there?
I told him.
Where does your mother work?
Fendale.
What does she do?
I told him.
How were they married?
I asked him what he meant.
I mean, were they married in the marriage court? Lobola, or what?
My father paid several cattle for my mother, and later the two got a certificate at the marriage court.
A lobola, that's what it is,
the interrogator said, writing everything down. He stood up, told me to go wait outside, and he would call me back. I waited for half an hour.
You have serious problems, he said,
perusing a stack of papers on the table.
What problems? Your parents' files here show that they don't have a permit to live in Alexandria,
he said with an important tone.
But my parents have been living together for over 20 years, and I have a brother and 5 sisters.
That doesn't mean anything. They're still living here illegally.
So what does that mean?
It means we can't start the pass process.
What do you want? I demanded. What more papers can I bring you?
I had notes from my principals, my birth certificate, my mother's and father's passes, rent receipts, my baptismal certificate. I was told I needed one before I could qualify for a pass, and other miscellaneous papers.
Your parents have to get a permit.
But this office refuses to give them one.
Your parents have to come with you.
My mother can come, but my father dare not miss a day. He'll be fired.
He's got to come.
But he'll be fired.
Then bring your mother.
Is that all?
That's all, he said. Oh, don't forget to bring the necessary papers.
Which ones?
I thought I had brought all necessary papers.
The necessary ones, he said impatiently.
Which ones? I insisted.
Don't be bloody cheeky, boy, he raged. You know that you don't have a letter from your employer.
But I'm not working, I said.
Then what do you need a pass for?
I need one to look for work.
You first find a job and then you apply for a pass.
But I can't hunt for a job without a pass.
That's your own problem, he said, standing up and heading for the door. Next, he called out to the long queue of pass applicants.
Where could I begin to look for a job?
Did I want a job?
I didn't want to work for Simba Quicks. Isando was too far. Besides, I might be told that my parents had to be residents of Tembisa for me to be eligible to work in Isando. One feature of the influx control law stated that blacks could not seek employment in cities other than those they lived in. If you lived in Johannesburg, you had to be employed in Johannesburg. To work in Pretoria, you had to get a special permit, which was rarely granted. One of the reasons why I didn't want to work outside Johannesburg was that the time I would spend traveling to and from work to Isando was something like 5 hours round trip. Would mean I had to stop playing tennis during the week, and I couldn't afford to do that. How anxiously I awaited news from America. I instructed George and my sisters to watch for the mailman each day for fear that because all the 20 households in the yard had a common postbox, someone might be filching my letters. No word arrived from Stan or George Tolley. I began to despair. Maybe going to America was just a dream that would fizzle away. After all, who was I to think that I could go to America? Being kicked out of black tennis had left me with few friends. It seemed people went out of their way to dissociate themselves from me. And the threats from the militants to stop associating with white people hadn't ceased. Each day I expected to be crippled or killed. My relationship with my father once more became strained. He couldn't understand why I wasn't working.
You mean your mother and I have fed you all these years for you to end up a loafer? He said one day. Why did we starve ourselves to send you to school for?
Find a job or else get out of my house.
I can't go on feeding a bearded child.
One day I returned home from tennis to find that my father, in his rage for my not working, had destroyed several of my books.
What he was looking for were your tennis rackets, my brother told me.
There was no use in arguing with my father over why he did what he did. He was right. I had to get a job.
Why don't you get a job and help me keep your brothers and sisters in school, my child?
My mother said to me one evening.
I looked at her. She appeared exhausted,
no doubt from being worked like a mule by white people. She washed and ironed for them, cleaned their homes, weeded their gardens, washed and fed their children, and catered to their every whim. Even when she was ill, she had hobbled to work. Even when any of my siblings was ill, she had gone to work, reluctantly. We had to eat, she would say. We had to have books and school fees. We had to pay rent. We had to have bribes for the policemen. She had recently been diagnosed as a diabetic and told to watch her diet, not to worry too much, not to work too hard. But she continued working too hard and worrying too much. There was no doubt she was suffering. Yet she remained upbeat, downplaying everything with a shrug and saying, "Any